It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, 86% of Wisconsinites who have tested positive for COVID-19 have recovered, at least according to the health department. But it turns out it's harder to measure recovery than we might think. First, our Food Friday guest is a self-described unapologetic procrastinator. She admits in the introduction of her latest book to writing that introduction the night before it was due. But that style of putting off work and then doing the work works for her. It also results in some pretty amazing baked goods. Erin Gardner is an award-winning cake designer, experienced pastry chef, blogger, and author. Her books include Erin Bakes Cake and her latest, Procrastabaking, 100 recipes for getting nothing done in the most delicious way possible. Erin, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's so fun to be here.
I think people may know the concept, if not the word. Talk about what we mean by procrastabaking.
Well, procrastinating is the baking you do when you should be doing something else.
And what do we get? What do you get, first of all, out of procrastinating? You are a big fan.
I am. Well, you know, I am somewhat unusual, even in the world of procrastinating, because while most people might bake to avoid, you know, writing a term paper or doing the laundry, I actually bake to avoid other baking.
Because that's your job. Like, you need to bake, you need to test recipes and things like that.
Yeah, I test recipes. You know, in the cake world, I come up with tutorials and designs. You know, I kind of freelance for different magazines and various online outlets. And when I need to sort of ramp my brain up to get into that creative mode, sometimes I'll make something easy and fun and, you know, just something delicious that I can share with my friends and family. So that was this book. This book is full of those recipes that I make when I'm avoiding what I have to do.
We'll spend most of our time on the baking part, but I want to spend a little more time on the procrastinate part. You were starting to talk about some of the benefits of procrastination. It gets a bad rap, but you've looked at some of the psychological research and things like that, and it actually sometimes, not always, but sometimes can help us to procrastinate. How so?
Well, I mean, if you need to justify anything, I am your girl. So I'll just tell you that right now. But yeah, there's, you know, I mean, I'm not a psychiatrist or psychologist, but there are different kinds of procrastinating. And I would like to think that procrastinating falls in the active procrastination category. So, you know, you're stoking the fires of creativity. You're taking a little break from things that might be stressing you out or, you know, the world at the moment, and, you know, just giving yourself some time in the kitchen where nothing else matters except for you and what you're making.
And I think probably a lot of us have experienced that sensation of you're plugging away at a problem, whatever it is, whether it's solving a baking problem or writing or whatever, and you grind away at it and you get nothing, and then you go do something else, something totally unrelated, and that's when the solution comes. Is that something that happens to you?
All the time. Absolutely. It's, you know, I think sometimes when you kind of get into that hamster wheel moment where you're just rolling over something too much, you have to set it aside and, you know, engage yourself in something else to keep the wheels turning, but to take a break from whatever it was that was really stressing you. And I think sometimes that's when the best ideas, the best, you know, moments of creativity can really happen.
We're talking to Erin Gardner about her book, Procrastabaking, 100 Recipes for Getting Nothing Done in the Most Delicious Way Possible. Is this you? Do you do this at your own home? Join in and tell us about it at 800-642-1234. Let us know what you bake to procrastinate. Again, 800-642-1234. Will you give some, before we get into some recipes you shared with us, I want to get into some of the baking, some like baking advice, things you say come up again and again in your recipes. Like, for example, scraping down the sides of the bowl of our batter. Why are we always wanting to do that?
Absolutely. Well, you know, it's so important if mostly when you're making, you know, any recipe that is using a creaming method where you cream, you know, you beat the butter and the sugar together, you know, sometimes with other ingredients, and then you add the eggs. And in each one of those parts of the process, it's always good to stop, scrape down the sides of the bowl. And that way you don't, you know, create any chunks of unwanted things in your finished product, and you give your finished product the best chance of coming out the way that you want it to when the ingredients are really properly dispersed throughout the entire batter.
And another tip you say just about every time, and this is something that it's an article of faith for me. I do it when I have anything in the oven, rotate it halfway through. Why do we want to do that?
Yes. Well, every oven is different. Every oven, I mean, I've used, I don't know, probably hundreds of ovens in my lifetime, and they all act a little differently, and you know, they all have their own personalities. There's hot spots and cool spots. So if you just show your baked good around the oven, it'll get the best of all of the spots and, you know, likely come out more evenly baked.
That is key. And I think my oven is just slightly off level too. So like, if I have something in oil, the oil will move over to the northeast, or, you know, the batter might smoosh over and it's uneven. So yeah, that rotation is key. I should probably deal with the level of my oven though, huh?
For sure. For sure. Or at least maybe, you know, like, the rack, maybe you can, shimmy the baking rack or something.
Maybe I'll try that instead. Well, you have shared a few recipes with us for our procrastinate baking needs. We've got them online at wpr.org/foodfriday. You've got a lot of cookies in your book. The one you shared with us is butter crunch cookies. The picture anyway looks fantastic. Tell us about these guys.
So good. Oh, they're my all time favorite cookie. They are everything good in the world. You know, chewy, crispy on the edges, butterscotch kind of flavored, brown sugar, a little salty, the little bits of crispy, caramelly toffee kind of pool when you bake them. They don't get sticky. It's a great simple toffee recipe that, you know, goes in the cookies. It's just a nice, it's a really satisfying cookie when you've got any kind of dessert craving.
And toffee is easier to make than I think it is, it looks like, if I'm reading your recipe right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I mean, we're talking butter and sugar. That's and you just heat it together until it gets, you know, kind of warm golden brown. Pour it out on a sill pad or a piece of parchment paper, and then just smash it up to bits. You know, it's kind of a fun stress reliever, to be honest. You know, smash up your toffee, dump it into the cookie, and then it makes just the most delicious little crispy pools in your finished cookie.
That looks fantastic. That's the Butter Crunch Cookie. Again, we have that online at wpr.org/foodfriday. Now, you cover cookies and, you know, my favorite, which is, you know, your bars and brownie types of things. You've got cakes and candies. I know you do it all, but do you have a go-to where you're like, okay, I need some good procrastinating here? Is there like your main go-to type of baking?
Oh, wow.
the All answer of the above, is baking. It could be,
I mean, I'd have to say cookies. You know, I put 100 recipes in the book, and 20 of them are cookies. You know, it's the biggest chunk of the book, and I'd say it's the biggest piece of my procrastinating baking life. You know, my kind of main gig revolves around cake, which I love cake, but cookies for me are lower stress, more fun to share. They can kind of hang around a little longer, and they're usually what my kids will reach for first as well. So they're just kind of more fun for us to have around at home, you know, on a day-to-day basis.
We asked our listeners on the Ideas Network Facebook page what their favorite things to bake are to avoid doing other things. We heard from Cassandra, who says banana bread. I'm not really into kneading. And I'm kind of there, too. I like, you know, quick bread type cooking, zucchini breads and things like that. Do you have any favorites in the quick bread family?
Oh, for sure. You know, I kind of fall in the same boat. Like, I am not a bread person per se. I like really simple, basic breads, but I love loaf cakes. And I have a banana bread recipe in the book. One of the cool things about it is I've broken the recipe down to work for however many rotten bananas you happen to have on your counter that day. Because, you know, that's always the thing. Like, oh, I want to make banana bread. And you've got two, but the recipe like calls for one or four, or so, you know, I kind of took the guesswork out of that and boiled it down to this is what you do for one banana, and then you can just go from there with however many you have on hand.
We're talking to cake designer and pastry chef Erin Gardner about her new book. It's called Procrastibaking, 100 Recipes for Getting Nothing Done in the Most Delicious Way Possible. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you do this? Do you procrastibake, bake something to, you know, maybe not get around to that other thing that needs doing, but it can wait till after the cake or cookies are done or whatever? What do you bake, whether it's for procrastination purposes or not? Do you have a favorite sweet treat to bake for yourself and or others? Do you have a question for our guest? She's covered it all in her book just about. She might be able to help out your baking pratfalls. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Find a few of Erin's recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our Food Friday conversation with Erin Gardner. Her new book is Procrastibaking, 100 Recipes for Getting Nothing Done in the Most Delicious Way Possible. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you bake? Do you bake sometimes to avoid doing something else, to put off doing something else? Do you find it valuable? Do you, when you procrastinate by baking, does it help you, you know, maybe solve other problems? And of course, what do you like to bake? What do you wish you could bake if you had the right advice? Maybe you can get that advice. Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. So for my personal baking choice, I love to bake a good strawberry rhubarb pie using strawberry rhubarb as well as strawberries. But the reason I called is yesterday my sister gave me this banana bread as a smaller loaf with cinnamon on top. That was the fruits of her procrastinating, which I'm super grateful for. And it was delicious. It didn't make it from Menominee Falls to like the zoo interchange. I mean, it was like done.
I'll point out to our guests that's not a very long way.
I figured, I mean, it sounds like you were really into it, and I'm into it now. That sounds great.
Fantastic. Marcus, thanks so much. Well, that fruit pie reminds me of, I want to share another recipe that you shared, blueberry buckle. What is a buckle?
Yes. I think it's predominantly a New England thing, but I mean, anyone can make it anywhere. It's basically like a light, fluffy, biscuity dough that you use to hold together a really absurd amount of blueberries. So if you like baked fruit, it's kind of like the loaf cake version of a cobbler. But it's a really, really terrific thing to make this time of year when, you know, blueberries are kind of abundant and headed on the way out. You can swap in some peaches, some, you know, chopped up apricots, whatever fruit you have on hand will work in that recipe. It's great for breakfast, too. I love it for a breakfast or a brunch.
Thanks a lot for calling in, Marcus, and sharing that pie. And I like your strategy of having somebody else procrastinate for you, too. That can't hurt. Let's go back to our callers now. Definitely. Mary Beth is with us in Thorpe now. Mary Beth, hi.
Hi. Thanks for
what do you want to tell
call
us about? Yeah.
Hi.
Yes. Over the years, I love making spritz cookies. I bought many different types of gadgets, and I just can't seem to make a good spritz cookie. I can make the dough fine, but I can't get it out of the canister. Mm. Could you give me some tips?
Sure. I think with spritz cookies, like you just mentioned, the tool that you're using is key. There's a lot of ones out there that have plastic parts, so then when you try to go and squeeze your cookies out, it kind of can fall apart on you if the dough is too firm. There are other spritz cookie makers. I can't think of any brand names off the top of my head, but they're made out of metal. And if you kind of, you know, look, search online or, you know, some baking supply stores, you can find ones with metal parts, which I highly recommend over the plastic ones. And then as far as the dough goes, you know, don't be afraid to warm it up a little. You know, if you need to put it in a zip top bag and kind of knead it a little with the warmth of your hands just to get the dough a little more pliable, that could help you get it out of the spritz cookie press. And also you can add a tiny bit of water to your dough if it feels too dry, if it feels too firm. You know, that shouldn't alter the consistency of the cookie too much. It'll just soften it enough so that you can get it into the shape that you want.
Fantastic, Mary Beth. Good luck. Report back and let us know how that worked for you. Don joins us now in Fish Creek. Don, hello.
Good afternoon, and thanks for the show. I don't know if what I'm doing could be called procrastinating at all, but I have a hand Corona mill, so I'm making Corona bread. But I just harvested 30 pounds of rye berries from my home garden that I'll be using for my baking. So I ground flour, and just before I heard the show on, I'm about ready to I did the second rise on my yeasted bread today, and I'm about ready to butter the bread pan. So I use a little combination of butter and whatever oil I have in the bread, and I use a Pyrex baking dish, loaf pans, and I never had anything stick. And so anyway, I've been doing bread for 40-some years, and I think I got started with the Tassajara bread book that I ordered through the first Whole Earth catalog or something way back.
Don, I got to ask you. You've been
Corona mill also. So anyway, I'll listen and.
I wanted to ask you though, Don. You've been baking all this time. Have you always been growing your own rye, or is that a new part of the operation?
I've experimented with the limits of home garden to market gardening, and I've been experimenting with growing grains, hulls, barley, oats, wheat, and rye. Wow. Rye is fairly easy. I figured out I'm a little bit mechanically inclined, and I figured out how to do some pretty good quantities of stuff with some everyday equipment as far as threshing, and we get a good breeze up here.
Wow. You've taken this to another level. I'm really impressed.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Don. And that makes me think you've got recipes in there, Aaron, where you can kind of inflate or deflate to fill the time you need. So you write in the book, some recipes, you can buy a pre-made dough or something like that, or I guess you can go to Don's extreme and start baking your bread in August by planting the rye in the spring.
I appreciate Don's level of commitment. I think that's really cool. But yeah, as far as the book goes, I have the recipes sort of divided up in each chapter by the ones that take the least amount of time at the beginning of the chapter, and then ones that take the longest time at the end of the chapter. And then in the book overall, the last chapter is called Procrastin Masterpieces. So if you really need to kill some time, and actually with the holidays coming up, that chapter could get a lot of use. Like I do a gingerbread house from scratch, some layer cakes and some roll cakes. Just those are the ones that, you can really just take a day and dive into your baking and have some fun.
Thanks again, Don, for calling in at 800-642-1234. Erin Gardner is with us. Her new book is Procrasta Baking, 100 Recipes for Getting Nothing Done in the Most Delicious Way Possible. We've got one more recipe I wanted to get into a little bit, a giant cinnamon roll scone. And
yes.
I gotta ask, sometimes I've never made scones myself, and part of why I fear them is that sometimes when I have other people's scones, they're kind of dry. They're like too dry for me. How do we make sure scones don't end up too dry?
Well, that is a scone pitfall. With this recipe, it's put together in such a way that there's enough butter, and then there's the liquid at the end that pulls it all together. I use heavy cream. So those two combined make for a pretty tender scone. The other thing that I do with my scone, in some recipes, you just press the butter into the flour and then kind of toss it all together with your fingers to make a dough. With mine, I go the extra step of then folding the dough, giving it a biscuit fold, so that way you end up with really flaky layers, and that those thin sheets of pressed butter sort of end up all throughout your scone, so that you don't have those dry, crumbly pockets like you do in some other scone recipes.
Wow, that sounds really good. And now why?
It's fun. Yeah, it's a good one.
Why are we doing giant scones? Just because we want to eat a lot of scone?
Because it's fun. Yeah, because why not? I was inspired by actually another baker, Michelle Lopez from Hummingbird High. She was working on a cinnamon roll scone recipe, and she was making little individual ones. And I thought, whoa, what if I just made a giant one and then cut it into wedges? Because, traditionally with a scone, you pat the dough into a big circle and then cut it into wedges and bake it. So I thought, oh, wow, how fun would it be if you could make the scone look like a giant cinnamon roll, cut it into the wedges, bake it. And, you know, it's an easy way to make a really big impact. If you're having a brunch, if you just want to have a really special breakfast for yourself or your family, you know, it just makes that impact. Like, everyone who sees it just wants to dive right in.
Now, one thing, I don't think it came up in your book, but, you know, with people stuck at home, they can't do out as much mm-hmm. stuff. Obviously, baking is a great thing. What do you think of baking as a group project for that family who's like, okay, we've all been on our phones for a while. Let's do something together that isn't not just watching another screen.
Oh, totally. No, I think it's a great way to, you know, I think it's a great way to bake with kids of all ages. I have young kids. I have a 9-year-old and a 5-year-old. Both of them love to help me out, but only to a point, you know. They kind of will tap out at a certain point. So then I know that's going to happen. So I know that I'm going to be there finishing the project. But I also think it can be a great way to connect with older kids. You know, I have friends and people that I know with, you know, tweens and teens at home, and it's really hard on them. You know, there can be more difficult to entertain than the little kids sometimes. So getting them involved in a recipe, you know, having that time together, I think can be a really great way to connect. And then a great way to kind of build self-esteem, where you see the fruits of your labor right in front of you, and you watch people enjoy what you've made.
In our last few moments, sources tell me, Erin, you're talking to us from your kitchen right now. Do you have a procrastinate baking project in your head that you'll work on this afternoon?
Oh, no, I think this after it's 90 degrees here where I am
fair.
In New Hampshire. So I'm going to work on ordering pizza this afternoon.
That sounds great. Well, you've got some no bake recipes too in the book. Maybe I'll think about those
sure.
as it heats up the rest of this
yeah.
month.
Yeah. No, Erin, I was actually just, sorry.
That's okay. Thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. This has been great.
That's cake designer and pastry chef, blogger and author Erin Gardner. And we've been talking about her new book. It's called Procrastibaking, 100 Recipes for Getting Nothing Done in the Most Delicious Way Possible. You can find 3 recipes that she shared with us at WPR.org/Food Friday, a giant cinnamon scone, blueberry buckle, and buttercrunch cookies. These look really, really good. Again, WPR.org/Food Friday for those recipes. Coming up after the news, a new WisContext article breaks down the different experiences of people recovering from COVID-19, with some feeling better after just a couple weeks, others still not feeling their normal selves after more than 3 months. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, state regulators have extended the utility shutoff moratorium until October as the COVID-19 pandemic continues to hurt the economy. We'll talk to a reporter to learn more about the decision and why there's been some pushback to the move. First, according to the Wisconsin Health Department website today, 87% of Wisconsinites who have tested positive for COVID-19 so far have recovered. But recovery, in public health terms, does not necessarily mean back to normal health and strength for people experiencing the symptoms of the virus. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you tested positive for COVID-19? What has your recovery process been like? What do you wish you'd known to expect? Call in at 800-642-1234. Mark Rickers is a digital producer with To the Best of Our Knowledge. He wrote the piece, Most COVID-19 Patients in Wisconsin Have Recovered. But what does that mean for WisContext? Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
There's a couple different meanings of recovery out there. Could you sort out what different people mean when they say recovered from COVID-19?
Sure. Well, I mean, there's the recovery in the, I guess, statistical sense. The way that the state tracks cases, positive cases, and how those progress. And then there's recovery in the sense that maybe I would think of somebody feeling back to their normal selves pre-COVID.
So in the public health way, it kind of means I can't spread the disease anymore, which is important to measure. Is that right?
Right. 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 I mean, like, for public health policy reasons, that's the most important thing to track. But it does mean that when you hear, 80% of our open cases have ended in recovery, it sounds like everyone in that group is feeling a lot better. But really, what that a better word for that category would be non-infectious or recovering.
To explain why that's important in the piece, you feature a Milwaukee resident, Adrian Lathan, who had tested positive for COVID-19 some months back. Can you share her story and her longer road to recovery?
Sure. So Adrian Lathan was admitted to the hospital with shortness of breath, numbness in her hands and feet, headaches, and just kind of pain all over. She had a really, really hard time in hospital with, she was fighting for 6 days and nearly died. She was sent home on oxygen. She was on oxygen for 30 days. Now, at that point, she was probably deemed as a recovery in terms of the statistical number because she wasn't infectious anymore. But, you know, she was at home on oxygen for 30 days, self-isolating, feeling extremely run down, hard to get out of bed, pain. And even, you know, maybe 2 months ago, she was still feeling maybe at half strength.
And that raises a question for, and you talked to some emergency room people about this, of what does it mean for someone to be recovered enough to send home from the hospital? Or are they bad enough to be admitted in the first place? Can you talk about what is on the minds of people who have to make that potentially life or death decision?
Sure. For an ER doctor, they're really thinking more about triage. So they're thinking about factors like, you know, is somebody going to benefit from hospitalization? You know, if they're somebody like Adrian, they're going to get admitted right away. But there's plenty of people who, you know, think they have the disease and they might go into an ER and they might seem like they're okay now, but they could crash later. At that point, an ER doctor might even be considering things like, how far away from the hospital do you live? Do you have people living with you? Are you at risk with any, do you have any other risk factors in your life? And really it just boils down to, are you going to be able to take care of yourself if this takes a really hard turn for the worse?
We are talking to Mark Rickers from To the Best of Our Knowledge about a piece he wrote for WIS Context about recovery from COVID-19 and what it means. So when public health officials use that term recovery, how are they actually measuring it? How do they decide, okay, this person is in this recovered data set?
Sure. So they determine this by one of three criteria. They're either checking to see if a patient is recovered from their fever, cough, respiratory infection, basically if their symptoms have cleared up. Then they're checking to see if they've isolated from others for 10 days since the onset of their symptoms. And if they can't confirm either of those things, they count someone as recovered after 30 days has passed since their positive test. The last one is the kind of the more curious one because it's just difficult. You know, health departments only have so many resources to follow up with people. So maybe they'll call someone and they're still experiencing symptoms, so they're not counted as recovered, but then there's never any other follow-up call just from lack of resources. At some point, officials have to deem that person as likely recovered. And so that's why after 30 days, they assume that they've recovered.
One thing that makes this complicated, Mark, is if I'm reading you right, somebody could be in that recovered category, but even still die because of complications from the original COVID-19 infection. Do I have that right?
That's something I did ask officials about. It is possible. It's very rare. And they tend to revise their numbers when they find that out. The time that would be the most likely to happen would be as a patient who maybe doesn't have health insurance, because after their initial test and initial, triage from an ER doctor or whoever they saw at first, after that, they wouldn't have any follow-up with a general care doctor. You know, they maybe would be afraid to go back to the emergency room.
Now, you shared Adrian Lathan's story from Milwaukee, and it sounds like there's this a community almost now of people who have had COVID-19. Sometimes they call themselves, I think, long haulers, people who still feel stuff 3 months in, and it's just not going away. What kind of stories, and do we have data on how many people that is right now?
The data is really only starting to come together just now. Some of these folks are, you know, calling themselves long COVID or the survivor core. And the common element is that because this disease can go on for so long and because the early narrative around the disease is that it resolved a lot earlier, they're having issues with even having people believe that they're still sick. Another aspect, and this is something Adrian went to, is that, you know, if you're sick for that long and, you know, you probably saw people around you pass away from the disease, you're going to have a fair amount of PTSD and mental trauma to deal with. And so that's something else that those groups are hoping to kind of support each other through.
Yeah. And that reminds me of, again, going back to Adrian's story. She survived COVID-19. She lost family members to the disease along the way, though. Can you share some of that part of her story?
Yeah, sadly, her father was actually hospitalized at the same time that she was, and he passed away at the hospital. Fortunately, because she had been released and was no longer infectious, she did get to go to his funeral. That's not the case for some who've lost some to this disease. And so she thought that was a small comfort, but it's still a really, really, really big loss that she's still getting over.
Now, with trying to figure out what recovery means here, Mark, in a lot of ways, it feels like we've been living with COVID-19 forever. It's still really new, right? And it sounds like, from reading your reporting on this, there's still some serious unanswered questions about how this disease will affect people long term.
Exactly. There are these common symptoms that are kind of emerging, things like brain fog, fatigue, strange numbness or respiratory symptoms that can go on for months and months. A lot of these are related to the autonomic nervous system, but they can kind of manifest in people all sorts of different ways. Generally, people who were hospitalized tend to have the symptoms for longer, but even people who recovered at home have been having some of these symptoms.
So having done this reporting, I mean, we see these statistics come out from the state every day. You can watch national statistics, things like that. What do you want people to know when they see statistics or an absence thereof of people recovered from COVID-19?
Well, one of the reasons we pursued this story was because we wanted to kind of illustrate that no one data point about this pandemic is really telling you the whole story. You want to keep an eye on how many cases are coming. You want to keep an eye on the state just recently released a metric for checking activity in your county. So you can see, you know, even if recoveries are up and we're seeing more recoveries in a given week, maybe in your county, there's a high amount of cases increasing and there's a much higher likelihood that the disease could be transmitted. It's about kind of learning to look at that data to kind of be more cautious, but not to like dissuade you from or maybe lull yourself into thinking that you don't need to be vigilant about keeping yourself and your family healthy.
Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Mark Rickers is a digital producer with To the Best of Our Knowledge, and he wrote the piece, Most COVID-19 Patients in Wisconsin Have Recovered, But What Does That Mean? He wrote that for WisContext, and you can find that over at wiscontext.org, along with a lot of other great reporting on COVID-19 and how to understand all the different sets of data that keep showing up out there. Coming up, we'll learn more about a decision by regulators in Wisconsin to extend a statewide moratorium on utility shutoffs for residential customers as the COVID-19 pandemic continues. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, recent polls show that there's a big partisan divide in not just who people are going to vote for, but how they're going to vote. A big difference between Democrats and Republicans when it comes to voting by mail versus voting in person. We'll break down the impact and what it could mean on Election Day with a Wisconsin political reporter. Now, in a 2-1 decision, Wisconsin's Public Service Commission has again extended the statewide moratorium on utility shutoffs for residential customers. The new rule goes to the 1st of October. That rule was originally put in place in March because of COVID-19 and the impact it had on jobs and the economy. According to recent reports, nearly a third of Wisconsin residential customers are behind on their utility bills. Our next guest has been following this story and joins us now to give us the latest. Danielle Kading is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News based in Superior. Danny, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me on.
Well, tell us a little more about this decision and what it means and who it's going to affect.
Yeah, sure. So like you said, they voted 2-1 to extend the moratorium until October 1st. They had previously voted 2-1 to extend it back in July to September 1st after we saw a rise in coronavirus cases after the state reopened following the striking down of the Governor Evers' safer at home order, or the state's safer at home order, I should say. And so since then, you know, there's been a lot of concern among various city officials, environmental groups about cases still being high right now. We're still seeing high activity across Wisconsin for COVID-19 cases. I believe there's only a handful or so of cases that of counties that don't have high activity. And also with, you know, the expiration of the federal unemployment benefit, that $600 a week payment, and schools that have shifted their reopening plans, you know, the commissioners Rebecca Valk and Tyler Huebner decided that, you know, it's probably in people's best interest right now to keep this moratorium in place.
Before we dig more into the pro and con, the Public Service Commission, not always a household word, I think, for people in Wisconsin. Can you remind us who they are and what they do?
Right. The Public Service Commission regulates utilities, electric utilities, water utilities, gas utilities throughout Wisconsin.
Now, talk about the rationale a little more for the two side of this vote, the pro vote. They raised concerns about not just the economic impact on people, but the health impact, it sounds like, if people lost their services during this pandemic.
Yeah, because one of the issues with that is, say, for example, if you shut off somebody's water right now, public health officials are saying, wash your hands to help prevent the spread of the virus. And if you shut off someone's water, where are they going to go to get the resources that they need? Typically during the summer months when water or power is shut off for people, after the lifting of the winter moratorium, people are directed to cooling centers or other shelters to get what they need. And the idea is that if they're doing that, they might be putting themselves in an unsafe situation where they're either not social distancing or just not in a setting that would be safe or prevent the spread of the virus.
As we mentioned, this is a 2-1 decision. Commissioner Ellen Novak was opposed to the extension, saying that it basically gives broad permission for some people to avoid paying bills. Here's a listen.
We shouldn't allow people of middle, upper income millionaires to be excused from paying their bills.
Can you talk a little more about the argument against extending the moratorium?
Yeah, she basically had argued that this was kind of encouraging bad behavior on the part of some people. And that also, you know, she cited the state's declining unemployment rate and also energy assistance funding that's available to customers who may be having difficulty paying their bills, saying that they should be directed towards that pot of money and seek out that assistance and set up deferred payment plans with their utilities if they're having trouble right now making ends meet. And she also was worried about the impact that keeping this moratorium in place would have on utilities by requiring them to provide a service without payment.
To make sure I understand this correctly, this just means that if somebody's not paying their utility bills, they can't have it shut down for now. This doesn't excuse them from liability for those bills, right? They still owe the same amount of money they owed, if I understand this correctly, Danny?
Right. Yeah, they would still owe the money. It just becomes a past due balance. And, you know, the more time goes on, the more that amount grows. And the idea is if people can't pay that later on, then the utilities are going to have to recover that money in some way. And the way that they would do that is by requesting a rate increase, which would mean that all customers would be on the hook for paying that off.
Talking to Danielle Kading, reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News based in Superior, looking at a decision from the state's Public Service Commission to extend this moratorium that says utility companies can't shut down customer services for non-payment. They extended that moratorium till the beginning of October. Now, we heard from one of the commissioners and from some state lawmakers saying this shouldn't be something that the Public Service Commission keeps doing. It should go to the legislature. What kind of argument are we hearing there?
Yeah, that was one thing that Commissioner Nowak had said, is that, you know, that maybe the commission was treading into territory that was best left to lawmakers and setting policy on this front, which was something that was echoed by Republican Senator Dewey Strobel. He filed comments before the commission on Wednesday prior to their meeting, saying that, you know, if the legislature thought that this is something that necessitated action or required action, they would have done it. But the lack of action on their part should send a message in that they think that it's time to let this moratorium expire.
Now, what have we heard from utility companies themselves, Danny, about the moratorium?
Yeah, utilities have been concerned for the most part about those past due bills, you know, among customers, because they don't want to have to request larger rate increases in order to recover that amount. Plus, you know, that means that they're also, you know, accumulating these costs during a pandemic. And so they're providing a service without getting paid for that. So, and that's a concern too, because about one third of people in the state right now, among utilities who provided information, are behind on their bills. So there's just a lot of concern about that number continuing to grow.
And now Wisconsin, we have a caller remind us that Wisconsin has a wintertime moratorium. I believe it usually starts in November.
Right.
So it's getting close to a point, if it's October and then it picks up again in November, to wrapping one into the other.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I think it's a question whether, you know, keeping this in place in October, even if you were to open it back up again and allow utilities to make disconnections, if they felt that that was an appropriate way to go, really, there's only a month in place before they're forced again to, you know, prevent those disconnections. So it really looks like utilities are in a bind right now, but at the same time, their customers, you know, we're seeing that a majority of people who qualify as low income customers are struggling right now to pay them. They're behind, and so are other customers. So it's a difficult situation, to say the least, that's being complicated by the pandemic.
And you mentioned that some people were suggesting people should go toward services that will assist in payment of utilities. Does Wisconsin have a lot of that kind of thing in place?
Yeah, and actually Wisconsin has the Low Income Heating Energy Assistance Program, and they actually received another $8 million as a part of CARES Act funding this year. So there's more money that's available to help people. And right now it looks like there's been more requests for assistance, that they're slightly higher, although it varies by location in the state. For example, it looks like as of the end of this week that in Milwaukee, there's actually fewer requests for energy assistance in Milwaukee County than the same time last year. But if you look at Dane County, it looks like those requests for energy assistance are up. And, you know, some of the reasons for that may be the fact that, you know, that supplemental funding for the $600 a week unemployment benefit expired at the end of July. And so I'm sorry, I forgot where I was going with that, Rob.
That's okay. Because in our last minute, I wanted to ask, what are you looking for next on this utility issue from the Public Service Commission or lawmakers or any of the stakeholders? What do you have your eye on as this story goes ahead, Danny?
Yeah, so the commission is going to take up this conversation again in September. I believe it's their September 17th meeting. And they're going to be talking about whether or not it's appropriate just to just continue this moratorium, and or whether they think it should be allowed to expire. And then also, you know, there's discussions right now about whether or not Congress will include additional funding for energy assistance, so people have money, more money available to pay their utility bills during this pandemic.
Danny, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Yeah, thanks so much, Rob.
Danielle Kading is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News based in Superior. She joined us today to talk about the decision by the state's Public Service Commission that will extend the state's current moratorium on utility shutoffs as the COVID-19 pandemic continues in Wisconsin. That moratorium now extended to the beginning of October. is this a story that is part of your life? Are you one of the people falling behind on your utility bill payments? Are you in commercial utility? Are you a commercial utility user? You're not getting that moratorium extended, I don't think. Whatever the case, or if you work for a utility yourself, we would love to hear your story and your perspective. Please email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Let us know how this utility story and this moratorium on utility shutdowns affects you in your own daily life. Snowing chocolate from the sky. That sounds like a nice idea, like a non-scary part of Willy Wonka sort of thing. But would there be a downside to chocolate raining down from the heavens? One town in Switzerland put that question to the test, but not on purpose. As reported by the Associated Press, the town of Olten in Switzerland got a taste of chocolate snow this week. A local chocolate factory there had a problem with the ventilation system for its cocoa nib roasting room. That sent cocoa powder out into the wind and left a thin layer of cocoa powder on the town. There are no reported problems for local health, happily, and the company offered to pay for any cleaning needed, but has had no takers as of the last report. So probably chocolatey snow, not such a great idea. It's up there with the time that I realized a movie theater sold Dove bars, you know, chocolate-covered ice cream bars. I thought, that's perfect, eating an ice cream bar while watching a movie. Not thinking about, you know, a chocolate chunky melting thing in a dark room falling into my lap through the entire movie. That pair of jeans was demoted from regular wear to around the house wear only. Got to be careful with our chocolate. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.